context adds as much value as your product does in a situation. And if we don't actually understand the context that people are buying our products in, we don't understand the struggling moment. We don't understand the pushes of what's going on. We don't understand the outcomes they desire. We literally end up giving them something that they don't want.
This is Outside Sales Talk, the best podcast for outside salespeople. I'm your host, Steve Benson, and we're here to chat with the world's top sales experts so that you can get their best sales tactics to level up your game. Welcome back to Outside Sales Talk. Today I have Bob Mesta with us, and he's going to be talking about what makes people buy. So demand side selling is the topic of the day. By way of introduction here, Bob is the co-founder at the Rewired Group, a design firm in Detroit, Michigan. Bob has developed and launched over 3,500 products and sold everything from design services, software, and houses to consumer electronics and investment services. So really all across the board here. He's also an adjunct lecturer at Kellogg School at Northwestern. That's Kellogg's business school and lectures, or I'm sorry, Northwestern's business school, and lectures on innovation at Harvard and MIT as well. Bob recently released the book, Demand Side Sales 101, Stop Selling and Help Your Customers Make Progress. Bob, welcome to the show. I'm really, really excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I'm excited to be here. This is like your listenership is kind of where I feel is like the ground floor of where I started most of my startups, which was like a countertop company and a language lab software company and all these things of just going around and traveling and having a territory and having to call on people. And so it's like it's bringing back flashbacks of like just like feet on the street, man. So it's really, really cool to be here. Glad to be able to help.
Well, I suspect that Badger wasn't around when you were involved in your first company, but
No, I'm pretty old. I'm 55. The way I always say it is, I've been breaking things for 50 years. I've been fixing things for 45 years, but I've been building things for 30 years. So, I've been making a lot of things for a long time, and I have fun every day and get to work in industries I never know about. So. It's great.
I love it. Well. First of all, let's back up. What is demand side sales?
Yeah. So demand side sales is a notion of like, so when I, so first of all, I've done 7 startups, I've built them and I sold them. And then I went and got a MBA. And one of the things that just kind of hampered me was this whole aspect of like, why don't they teach sales at business school? And why don't they teach sales as a startup? Right. They always teach you how to raise money and they teach all these, and you start to realize that at some point in time, the business schools and everybody sees sales as kind of very, very tactical and kind of psychological and a bunch of tools and tricks. And even though it's a process, it's very focused on product. And so to me, I took a step back and said like, all right, how do we reframe this a little bit? And one of the things is one of my very first startups, I was a countertop company and I'm an engineer. And one of those things was like, oh, I can learn sales. How hard is that? I go learn, basically I took a couple of classes in sales. I end up getting a funnel. I end up figuring out the features and benefits. And, you know, I go and I call in the kitchen and bath stores and I call in Home Depot. And for some reason, every time I'd walk out, I'd have this pit in my stomach that made me feel icky. I was just trying to push and I was trying to actually convince them and I was trying to figure out all the stuff. And it got to the point where I was trying to sell a countertop to anybody and everybody. And I couldn't turn it off. And this one guy I worked with, he says, no, you need to stop worrying about basically how to sell your product. You need to just help them figure out how to buy. And from that point on, and I had been doing innovation for a long time before that, but I had that premise of, I need to understand the job that they're hiring the product to do. What job is open that I need to slot this product into? And so the demand side sales is really about understanding the causal mechanisms of what happens in people's lives to say, today's the day I need a new teeth cleaning machine. I need a new hearing aid. I need, whatever it is, everything is caused, nothing is random. And that trying to understand that causality of what causes people to buy enables me to sell better. And so that's the basic premise behind demand side sales.
So what would you say, how would you describe the differences between demand side selling and supply side selling?
Oh, that's a great question. So what's interesting is that I grew up on the supply side of the world, especially as an engineer. It's like, you build a product, I make mattresses. Okay, who needs mattresses? And it's like, okay, well, hotels need mattresses, and you know, colleges need mattresses, and individuals need mattresses. And we define the market of everybody we talk about by the mattresses we make. But when you really look at it, I think of this huge wall between the demand side and the supply side, and that it's 10 feet thick and 100 feet high. And when you take it and you climb over this wall to look at the demand side, all you see is like a million people, and you see segments, and you see markets and channels. But nobody seems to ask, like, what causes somebody to say, today's the day I need a new mattress? And what happens if we do, we look at like Saturday, the day they bought it. And we don't realize that the fact is like, it's been 3 years of them thinking about a mattress to finally, and not sleeping, for them to cause to get a mattress. And so part of this is that the supply side tends to focus on what I would call is the product, and it focuses on competition in the product. But on the demand side, the number one competitor to a new mattress from the demand side is ZzzQuil. How many bottles of ZzzQuil do you have to take before you realize you got a bad mattress? And so you start to realize that people have all these compensating behaviors. And so you see the world in a very different way when you realize, how do people actually buy? What's the language they use? What's the information? We end up trying, from the product side of the world, the supply side, we try to teach them our language of how to buy a mattress. What's the foam? What's the density? Is it spring? Is it a hybrid? Does it have cooling in it? And it's like, literally, my thing is, Casper could walk into this market of a very crowded market of mattress makers and literally carve out $1 billion of sales by asking very simple questions like, do you stick your leg out at night? Right? That's what customers would say is like, I know I'm hot when my leg is outside the thing, versus somebody does, are you hot at night? Well, that depends. But if you say like, do you stick your leg out? Yes. Okay. You probably need cooling. And so it listened to the language that customers use, and it actually then translate all those features and benefits we have into the way in which the customer or the consumer really wants to make progress.
I really like looking at it that way. That's fantastic. It really puts you in the customer's headspace and their mind frame.
Yeah. Well, and it's the quest for value. Like again, I was being brought up on the supply side. I'd say, oh, people would value this and people would value that. And what I realized is context creates value. And if I actually have my product in the wrong context, it doesn't matter how much I want to charge for it. It adds no value. So
give me an example of that.
So do you like steak or do you like hot dogs?
I like both.
That's right. So here's the thing. Let's think about the last hot dog situation. When did you have hot dogs?
You know, I haven't had a hot dog for a while, honestly.
Yeah. So let me tell you, I have four kids. The fact is they all play hockey. They're literally, we're running home from hockey practice. I throw some fries in. I got some carrots I cut up, and I literally throw tater tots and the hot dogs in, and we have dinner in literally less than 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I throw a steak in that situation, and it literally is a horrible experience. Right. They're not going to want to eat it. It takes too long. The fact is everybody wants it different forms. Like, and if I take a steak situation, the last time I had steak, which was celebrating my wife's birthday, and I put hot dogs in it, and I'm literally in the doghouse. And so what mm-hmm. you realize is context actually creates the value for each one of those things to fit into your life. And that you don't like steak and or pizza or steak or hot dogs. You like them both based on the context when we are going to actually pull them into your life. And so I believe that that context adds as much value as your product does in a situation. And if we don't actually understand the context that people are buying our products in, we don't understand the struggling moment. We don't understand the pushes of what's going on. We don't understand the outcomes they desire. We literally end up giving them something that they don't want.
Makes a ton of sense. So how can a salesperson focus on selling from the customer's vantage point to get around all those problems?
So the first thing for me is again, I apologize that I'm an engineer, but I overthink it a little bit. But I take so my big secret is I go back and say, tell me about the last three or four sales. What caused somebody to say, today's the day I want to buy your product? And what happens is what's interesting is the story that I hear from salespeople and the story I hear from customers are actually really different. because the salespeople talk about the features. They talk about, ooh, they want to get a deal. They negotiate real hard. But you talk to customers and they'll say like I had this problem. This wasn't working. I needed to replace that. And they talk about it at a much bigger level. So the first thing I try to do is go back and talk to the last three or four people who bought from us. And from that, I actually learned their language of what they thought they were doing. I think Peter Drucker said it best is, you know, despite how much companies know about the customer, customers rarely buy what the company thinks it's selling. Right?
So true.
And so it's one of those things when you hear, that's where that wall comes in. When you hop over that wall and you literally go like, help me understand what's going on. Like, why today? What made this special? Why? Like there's a difference between restocking, if you will, and buying something new. And that I'm talking about more about when somebody buys something new. Like if you use Tide every week and you go to the grocery store and you buy Tide and I ask you, God, what caused you to buy Tide? You just literally make it up. Oh, it smells good. It gets my clothes clean. You don't. But when you switch from Tide to Cheer, or you switch from Cheer to Tide, that actually helps me understand what progress you're trying to make. So instead of trying to talk to 100 people who buy the same thing, I only talk to people who switch, because when they switch, out of the murky swamp comes actually the underlying causal reasons of why they do what they do. And this is where people will pay more. This is where people will, they'll say like I just did one of like, I did a talk on this notion of like, nobody really wants a loan. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, nobody wants a loan. They want a new house. They want to grow their business. They want like, the loan is there to do something. So you talking about the rate and the terms and the closing costs and like, help me understand how this fits into my life. Don't talk to me about the supply side language of the loan. Tell me about why in the world, what are you going to do with the loan? And that's really why people buy a new loan.
Right. Right. No, that makes a ton of sense. So, Well, how does this fit in with so in your book, you described some key frameworks for how people buy. Could you talk about some of these frameworks on how people buy?
Yeah, this is where, again, it gets a little, so the thing is people would always say like, you know, if I ask somebody like why they bought a new car, they say, oh, I got a deal on it. I'm like, that's not why you bought a new car. It might be how you chose the new car. But what caused you to get a new car is your old car had 87,000 miles on it and you just had a repair that was over $2,000. And the fact is at some point in time, you just had your third kid. And the fact is you need something like, it's the context wrapped around it. So we talk about what we call the forces of progress. And there's four different forces. There's a push of the current solution. Like something that's going on with your current situation that says, this is not going well. It embeds in a struggling moment of like, God, we could do better, right? I don't know what the answer is, but there's a whole bunch of different things wrapped around it. The second thing is this what we call the pull of the new solution. And that's really this aspect of like, once they see kind of the new solution, they look at it and go like, oh God, that's interesting. That'll help me. And they'll talk about features, but what you have to do is figure out what are the real outcomes they want from those features, right? But every time somebody looks at something new, there's these two other forces which are counter to making progress. I call it the anxiety of the new, which is this notion of like, when I see it new, like, well, what am I going to do about this? And how do I not know that? And then there's the habit of the present, which is the thing you love about the old product. So one of the startups I worked on was I built 1,000 homes here in Detroit for first-time home buyers, divorced family with kids, and downsizers. Think of like your parents, right? And so there's a set of forces to say, like, why in the world do your parents need to downsize, right? What's causing them to do it now? Irrelevant of what they buy, but why do they want to move? It's like, again, I'm in Detroit, so it's we've got snow, we've got changes of weather. Typically, the house is going to be anywhere from 2,500 to 3,500 square feet. It's like the house is too big. I don't want to do the maintenance. It needs a bunch of work. The kids have moved away. Those are all things I say. The phrase I use is bitch. This is where people will bitch about something, but they won't necessarily do anything about it until they see a solution. So I say bitching ain't switching, right? The moment they see my condo, it's 1,654 square feet, 2-bedroom, 2.5 bath, first floor laundry, gourmet kitchen. Like, your parents walk in and go like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, this is the kitchen we've always wanted. This is like, it's got a brand new roof. It's you know, the laundry, we don't have to climb up and down stairs. So those are all the things that are attracting them. And it's more or less like, we can live a simpler life. We can stay here a lot longer. We can go to, we can travel, lock the door and go travel and see the kids. But then you end up with the, what we call the anxiety of the new, which is like, how are we going to move? We got 3,000 square foot of stuff and 1,500 square feet. That's not going to work. Like where's the grocery store? Who's our neighbors? And you start to realize there's all these anxiety forces, right? And then they start to realize that there's these habit forces of like, this is where we raise the kids. This is our neighborhood. This is where we go to church. Like there's all these other things. So part of it is to understand what causes somebody to say, finally, today's the day we're going to move. And so by understanding these forces, I'm able to, so one of the things I did is I realized like moving was a very big traumatic thing for people. And so I'm a builder and I build houses and you're supposed to like, everybody says, I want granite, I want hardwood floors, I want, this and I want that. But it turns out that one of the biggest things holding people back is the fact that they don't know what to do with all of your stuff that you haven't taken from the house. And they don't want to throw it out. So what I did is I actually raised the price of the condo. I literally included moving and 2 years of storage in a place I built across the street and a sorting room in the clubhouse where they moved to. And I got a 22% increase in sales because I reduced the anxiety of what am I going to do with all my stuff. And so part of this is understanding that how people buy is actually a system and that there's patterns in that system. And though everybody's story is different at one level, the next level up, you start to realize like there's only four or five reasons why people really buy a new condo or buy a new house or buy a new machine or switch countertop companies. And so by understanding those patterns, that's how I've been successful in selling.
And is this the struggling moment that you talk about?
Tell
us about what is the definition of the struggling moment that a customer or a prospect would have?
So one of the things I worked on a long time ago was Snickers, right? What's the struggling moment when you need a Snickers?
I need to be satisfied. I'm hungry.
No. Well, here's the thing is no, satisfied is the outcome. The struggling moment is you're hungry. And I'll be more specific. You missed probably the last meal. Your stomach is growling. You've got a bunch of work to do, but you don't want to eat something that's going to make you feel too heavy or spoil your next meal. And so when you're hungry and you're not you, Snickers satisfies. We don't talk about packed with peanuts. We don't talk about all the features and benefits of Snickers. We talk about the context that it's in and the outcome that it gives you. And it goes from a $650 million product to a $3.5 billion product. Right? And so part of this is that the context actually adds more value than just the product alone. So that's the key is that if we start to think about both the sales and the marketing to help us actually find the moments when people are ready to buy, as opposed to convincing people to buy, and that using, so one of my mentors, so I have four mentors, and this is my, for those of you listening, I have in my video, I have my four mentors across the room, and my mentor number four is a guy by the name of Dr. Deming. And Dr. Deming, when I was 18 years old, I was lucky enough to have, he hired me to be his intern. And Deming was the person who in 1949 went to Japan to help MacArthur rebuild Japan's infrastructure. And he is the father of Lean or the Toyota production system. And he would always say, don't ever confuse correlation with causation. Like, just because I'm this old and I have this income and I live in this zip code, that doesn't mean I'm ready to buy anything. How do we actually understand what causes me to say today's the day I'm going to buy? And so what happens is a lot of times we end up using, marketing correlation data to say who our prospects are. But the reality is that we have to know a lot more about their context and their outcome to know if we can actually bring value to them.
And
I don't know if I'm resonating or not with the listenership. So help me get it granular down to calling on people.
Yeah. So specifically, how does a salesperson who is an outside salesperson tap into that customer's struggling moment? Yeah. How do you identify, or what are some thoughts around how do you identify? And you can use me as an example, right? Yeah. Like what Why does a field salesperson, what is the struggling moment that they would have that would cause them to buy Badger and to,
right.
to, and have more efficient routes and schedules? How do I tap into that?
So think of it this way, that you can say, well, these are people who want directions. These are people who want to be efficient. Like, you can sit on the supply side and think of all the possibilities of why somebody wants Badger, right? Mm-hmm. And you can sit in a conference room and figure that out.
Right.
But the reality is when you hear the stories, you start to realize there's very specific things that have to happen. We have to be growing, right? It's something where we're growing, or we have high turnover in our sales force, and that people aren't getting covered. We're getting spotty pieces in the cover. What are the real pains that they have that make them aware to say, like, God, we gotta get a new way to do this. Like, my belief is they're not looking for your solution. They're actually trying to solve a very specific problem of coverage, or, you know, try to teach onboarding or something else. And you're talking about all the perfect pieces of it, but the reality is, like, their thought process is way back up front in terms of, like, boy, we, you know, how do we, if we're growing and we're gonna acquire, we need a better way, a more efficient way to have our salespeople. We need to have our salespeople cover more space, right?
Yeah, our customer research shows that most field salespeople identify with the problems. Like, they would say, my routes are not that efficient, or I need help figuring out which customers to focus on given where I'm going to be, or I'm late for meetings and customers cancel meetings and I have holes in my schedule as a result. It's inefficient.
Yep.
They'll describe. They will resonate with the problems that we solve, and yet most field salespeople would resonate with those problems. Only a few field salespeople go to our website,
right?
Search the web for routing software for sales. Find us, go to our website, and purchase it.
So here's the other thing: is like, we think about these as check the box. Like, if they feel any one of these things, they're gonna buy. And as you start to listen to, like, this is where you have to talk to somebody who didn't use you before and literally in the last 90 days went and bought you. Say, like, what in the world happened for you to say today's this is it? Because it might be that they need three or four of these things, not just one. Or they might need something else that you actually don't even know about. The fact is like, at some point they're putting in a new system, and the fact is their old system is going away, and they need something to complement their system. And so part of it is to understand what's their view of what caused them to do this, not your view.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point their view is always larger than yours. Because you just think of other people who actually do routing software, and they're literally thinking, like, I'm actually trying to manage turnover, and you don't talk about turnover at all.
Mm-hmm. And I think that A challenge here is also figuring out how, as a company, you can tap into this struggling moment, as you're describing, like finding the person who is now ready to purchase something at this point. And maybe that's why Google's such a successful company. Like, one great way to tap into someone's struggling moment is they're searching for a solution.
But here's the thing: this is the second framework. The second framework is really about the timeline. So this is where I'm going to share. I can't help myself anymore. Right. So when we talk about these forces, right, and we want people to understand what's pushing and pulling them and the anxieties and habits that get there, the other part is there's a timeline involved. The crazy part is that everybody has to have a first thought that they need to do something better. If they haven't had the first thought, they actually can't remember anything you tell them. So the way that what I talk about is questions create spaces in the brain for solutions to fall into. The worst thing that we do is we ask a question and then we answer it. You should ask a question and let that simmer inside people, because they need to actually figure out is it a problem they need to solve? How long, right, have you not been able to sleep? And shut up. Don't say, oh, I got mattresses. No, I don't need a mattress. Like, how long haven't you been able to sleep? Shut up. Mm-hmm. How long have you done, like, and that's where we get to what we call this first thought. And then they go into passive looking, where passive looking is where they have to learn about it themselves to say, like, is this really a problem? Is this something I have to address? Is this big enough? I don't even know how to search for a solution. This is where they go from talking the, what I call the problem language, to the solution language. And then they go to active looking. And active looking is literally like the kid in the candy store. This is where they go like, oh, can you do this? Oh, can you do that? It's like magic wand thinking. They want you to do everything, but they haven't really connected the dots yet. And so this is where they say they want everything. It was like, if you don't do this, we can't buy you, right? And it's this notion of they haven't managed the trade-offs. Deciding is actually about framing and making trade-offs. If you want this and you want to get it this far and it's going to cost you that much and we can do it in this time frame. Otherwise, we can do this and do that in this time frame and do this, making them choose. If you actually just give people one offer, the choice becomes do something or do nothing. And most people choose to do nothing. My thing is what you want to do is actually give people three options, because three options force them to, first thing people do when you give anybody three options is they eliminate one right away. They always eliminate, they don't pick one, they eliminate one. And then after they eliminate one, what they do is they take the two that are left and they don't compare them to each other. They compare them to the one that they eliminated. And ultimately they don't pick the one they want, they just eliminate the two they didn't want. That's actually how most people make decisions.
Makes sense, yeah. And so
part of this is when people are, where are they in the timeline? And what forces are acting upon them? And so the hard part is we think of every time we call in somebody, we should be closing them. And it turns out like that's not the case, because they might be in passive looking, and what you need to do is educate them about the problem they have and helping connect it to the solutions that are possible. And if you try to close them too early, you actually build mistrust.
Sure. And how can a salesperson better understand the buyer's timeline and then know where a buyer is along their timeline?
So this is the craziest thing that I like, since I've been doing this for a while, but it's one of these things where it's like, most of the time we talk about where people are in our sales process, but very few people ask them where they are in their buying process. Most people go like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, are you just trying to figure out whether it's a problem or not? Are you looking at many different options? Are you trying to decide? And if you actually start to see where they are in the timeline, you actually realize they have very different questions. They actually have very different language. And so what you actually end up, what I end up helping the salespeople understand is like when they say, I need to know, it's all about passive looking because they haven't talked to anybody about the problem yet. But when they say, well, we need to do this, that's typically active looking. And deciding is about like, how's this going to work? Who's going to be against it? And so you start to realize that every sale has its own set of languages to it, depending on where they are in the timeline and the forces that are acting upon them. And so to me, by studying and understanding how people buy, you actually start to see the patterns that there aren't infinite, there's not one way to buy and there's not 100 ways to buy, but there's four or five different pathways that people buy. And when you understand it, you then know how to actually talk about value. I think half the problem is we show up and we throw up and we give them every feature and benefit and they go like, I need a discount because you know what? I don't need half of this stuff. And if you literally just didn't tell them half the stuff, they would have bought it at full price.
Sure. Right? Yeah, no, I think this is a key issue you're talking about here. How do you think that a salesperson can figure out where to be at the right place at the right time? Like how can they identify, this customer is here and therefore I've got to catch them right there.
So that's what we're doing. We've been flipping the lens on the sales funnel and talking about the buying timeline. So when we talk about it, we talk about what job are they trying to get done? Which pathway are they in? And where are they in their timeline? And what we do is we talk about not how to get them to close, but how do we actually help them make progress from passive looking to active looking, or from active looking to deciding? And what do they need to know? So instead of trying to get everybody to close, here's the thing is we run promotions primarily because I call it the Church of Finance wants to actually make sure we meet a number that we guessed about a year ago. And the reality is they'll take a 20% discount to buy it today because we need to actually meet a number. And the reality is they would have paid full price if we actually understood their timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. I used to struggle with that when I was at larger companies and my boss's boss would want it in by a deal to get done by this specific date.
Right. And to be honest, you're doing a disservice to the customer because at some point you teach them just like the furniture business. If I just wait, they're going to actually have a sale.
And a disservice to the company too, because I
exactly
if given a little more time, I would have I could grow the deal to be much larger in size, or I could have gotten full price.
So this is why I feel that the sales process is more a function of the Church of Finance and the marketing people than it is about sales. And when you actually talk to really good salespeople, they know all of this about their customers. They understand the professional side of being a salesperson. They understand what causes people to buy and know how to, let's be clear, to be a really good salesperson, you have to be one of the smartest people in the company. You got to know about the product. You got to know about delivery. You got to know about the customer. You got to know about pricing. You got to know everything. And so this is why I go like, why is this not taught at business school? Right? Because what happens is we end up turning them into order takers. And the reality is that's when the disaster happens. Because we're not actually focusing on them. We're actually selling to feed the beast as opposed to help people make progress. That's why I called it demand side sales.
Makes a ton of sense. I mean, I always felt like some of the best salespeople are the ones that understand everything. They understand the company, they understand the business, right. They understand the customer, they understand the product. And I think it should be taught in school, certainly business schools, because, you know, yes. I mean, sales and marketing that's everything in business. Yeah,
but here's the thing is that we all sell. A teacher sells to a student the lesson. A mm-hmm. doctor or a nurse sells the patient their rehab program. And it's not really that they sell it. They actually just help them figure out how to make progress. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is if you go in and talk to a school and try to say, like, how do we help you innovate? What you do is you talk to teachers and they want to actually help make teaching better, but it actually doesn't help learning be better. mm-hmm. And so that's why I talk about the supply versus demand. The supply side is teaching. The demand side is learning. How do we actually help people learn better? Not how do we teach better?
Well, is this the key to being a great salesperson? I guess I should ask, what do you believe makes a great salesperson?
So the thing is that I think it's the knowing where value is and knowing when to say no and helping people make progress will always actually get you more value than anything else. And so to me, the best salespeople are people who listen. They're people who actually, they enable people to see options. They educate them along the way, and they actually help people make trade-offs. And the thing is that most really bad salespeople, they actually just push their product, they convince people, and they back them into a corner to almost say, like, they bully them to say, like, well, if you don't do this, like, what are you going to do? And then they leave them alone. And so they literally don't enable, and they push features and benefits that don't necessarily work. And so I think I had a sales guy like 6 weeks ago tell me a great story. He goes, we would go find the pain that somebody had, and then we would totally distort the product to fit into that pain. I'm like, well, could it solve it? He goes, I didn't know. I was just told to distort the pain. I'm like, if you can't help somebody, like, this is does you no good to try to sell somebody something somebody's not going to use. Like, that doesn't help anybody.
Right. Well, especially in the world of modern software where they pay monthly or annually and they'll just stop paying. That doesn't happen. Right. You want to only sell to people who and make them and invest in their success, right? I mean, you have to get them successful with the product so they keep buying it forever because it creates so much value for them.
So one of my questions, so when I work with software companies, I have a qualifying question I ask them. I said, so tell me what your zombie revenue is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they'll say, what do you mean? I'm like, I want to know how many people are paying for you and have not logged in the last 90 days. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean? I'm like, how many people are paying you every month for your product, but they're not actually using it? And like, oh, and you get three answers, right? You get like 27%. You get crap. That's a great question. We've never measured that. And the third one is, yeah, I'm not sure we could answer that because if we answer that, then I'm going to have to tell my board and what's wrong with people who basically pay for it and don't use it? That's not a bad thing. I'm like, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah. They're not going to be paying for it for long.
I would say they're one credit card expiration date away from being fired, and they've already been fired and they don't know it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I like that concept. That's good.
The other thing I always talk about is the fact is like when people fire you, they're still making progress. in their minds, I got rid of you to do something different or better. And so do you actually know why you're getting fired? Because what happens is we make excuses of why people fire us. But the reality is like they think whatever they're going to is better from some new dimension that you're not actually seeing. So if you don't actually understand not only why people hire you, but why people fire you, you will actually never be able to grow.
Yeah, this is, I've always been huge on this. I want us, whenever someone quits at Badger, I want to know why, and we capture the information.
So here's the difference is that the thing that most people get, you were just too expensive and then they stop.
Yeah, no, you have to go deeper than that. You have to really put, I want people to talk to them and really find out. I mean, you know, well, until this year, it's December of 2020 and we're having this conversation. This year, it's all, because we're going out of business or because I'm fired or, you know, up until now, this year's not that, the answer's not that interesting, but historically, you know, it's been much more interesting. And a lot of, sometimes it's, we're not going out into the field anymore. Sometimes it's, we're going out of business but this year has been a little boring.
So here's the thing. And this is the thing I've been advising a lot of people on lately is like, okay, fine. They're going to go out of business. What's the next, it's not going away. Somebody's going to need to buy something from somebody else and there's going to need to be CLP. How is it going to work? What is going to be the new way? Like if you look at any of these major events, like, you know, 2007, 1999, 2005, like there will be more entrepreneurial systems that are built up that you won't even see for the next 4 or 5 years that will crush you, that you won't even see happening because somebody else figured out a different way that, I don't need to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thing is it's not just the fact of, okay, they're firing me because they're going away. It's like, all right, how is that job going to be replaced?
Right.
However it's going to be replaced. And if it's not traveling, they still need to know how does your technology enable them to still help do those things? And so this is where you got to look at the world in a different place and ask again, why 5 more times? And most people are stopping. Well, we're going to go out of business. I'm like, okay, who's going to take their place?
Right. Yeah. And for us, a lot of it's just their industry's in trouble. So it's like, we're a field sales team that sells to restaurants, or someone just quit a couple weeks ago. They sell exercise equipment to gyms and gyms are generally closed. And the ones that are open aren't buying new equipment, from what they tell us. So there is a lot of that. I think they all do just come back, you know, once the world gets back online here. But what will it look? That's a great question that you're asking. What will it look like? Will it look the same? Will it look different?
Well, here's the thing is, think of it this way. So I'm working with schools. I work with higher ed, but I also work with like K-12 school. I have this one K-8 school I'm working with. And they're like, we just want it to come back to normal. It's going to get back to normal. And I'm like, no, it will never be how it used to be. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, at some point in time, there will be no more snow days. You will just have a virtual day. Oh. Mm-hmm. And then I'll say like, and some kids are actually learning more virtually than they are face to face. Like, oh, that's not true. And you start to look at it and like, holy crap, they can actually learn all their material in half the day. Like, what are they doing for the rest of the half of the day? Like all of a sudden you start to realize like some kids are going to actually prefer virtual. And so how does that work? And so all of a sudden you start to realize like there will, when we get back to quote normal, the things we're learning, like we're innovating every single week at this school, every single week. We've innovated more in 4 months than we have in the last 40 years in education, in my opinion. And they think they're going to go back to normal. I'm like, no, none of this is going to actually, like there are stuff here that's going to stick for a lot longer than, you know, coming back in July. And so this is the kind of thing where you have to realize like, people are not going to go to the grocery store anymore unless they want to find new things. If they know what they want and they have the order, my belief is they're going to go order their stuff and then they're going to basically go pick it up. And in the meantime, they're going to go walk and buy the 10 things that they didn't put on that they didn't know about. So they're going to walk through the grocery store as a way to find the new stuff, not the way to actually buy the old stuff.
Mm. Interesting. Right? Yeah, so put it on automatic order, basically.
All these new things are literally what we don't realize is people are making progress in their life and we aren't watching it. And we're assuming people are going to come back to the way they were. it ain't going to be that way. This is where entrepreneurialism is critical, because we're going to see hybrids of stuff all over the place. My favorite right now is I have 15 kids at this school who are actually not in the state anymore. And the way the state works is the state's the one who funds all the education. They have their primary residence here, but two are in Florida, two are in Minnesota, two are like, they're all over the country. And you're like, well, why can't education be like this all the time? Why can't we actually have kids working from, like, if they can work remotely and it works, why not actually? So you start to realize, like, oh my gosh, this is going to change a lot of the ways in which we think about funding of education.
Yeah. Very. Right? Yeah,
I know I'm going bigger, but like, my thing is your listenership are the people on the front lines, and they see the struggling moments and they see what's going on. And what I would say is that people can struggle for enough time, but once we realized this was not going to be a 3-month thing, everybody went and bought a comfortable chair because they didn't want to sit on the dining room chair. Mm-hmm. They're going to start doing new stuff. And we have to actually understand, where are those things that they're really struggling with? And when they come back, they're going to struggle again, because it's like, oh my gosh, we don't have, like, we had to lay people off. Now we don't have, like, half the restaurants, at least around here, have a problem where the unemployment is so great that they can't actually hire people to come back and serve.
Right. Yeah. It's a challenge everywhere, I think.
Well, and so part of this is to actually say, all right, well, what do we do to solve it? This is, so the silver lining to me to the pandemic as an innovator is, again, innovation happens when there's a struggling moment. Well, because everybody's now struggling, we're all innovating at a very different rate than we did a year ago. We're all changing the way we think. We're changing the way we vacation. We're changing literally everything. And at some point, it's putting some industries upside down, and it's literally making other industries tremendously successful. But the reality is, like, people are making progress, and there's a whole bunch of what I call non-consumption. People who want to make progress and can't wait for this to be over, and there's going to be a huge boom of things that people want to do. So if you look at the economy after the 1918 Spanish flu, huge boom. Because at some point, people then finally had the ability to kind of go do things they couldn't do in a long time. So to me, it's just a matter of, let's get the vaccine out. Let's basically get past this, but let's not fool ourselves. We're not going back to Kansas.
Mm-hmm. It's a new world. Well, let's jump into the next section is sales in 60 seconds. So quick question, quick answers. Yeah. What do you think the most common mistake sales reps make when they start their career in sales?
That they feel like if they know everything about the product and they can actually answer all the product questions, that they can actually sell the product, and that they don't listen.
There you go. So what in your opinion is the most challenging part of sales?
I think for me, the most challenging part of sales is being able to actually interrogate a prospect to understand where they're coming from when they're very guarded. And so it's a way in which to hold a conversation and to be very, very observant of a lot of subtle things that give me all the clues to know what are they really struggling with. Like, listening to the ways people say something versus what they say. So if I say, yeah, God, you know, your product, it's good, versus, boy, your product's really good. Transcript says the same thing, but the first one is like, all right, what's wrong with it? The second one is like, what do you like about it? Right? And so part of it is learning the subtleties of being able to read people and understand what they mean.
And how do you prepare for a meeting with a new prospect?
Okay. This is where I would say I'm sure that nobody says, I actually want to know as little as possible.
Why is that?
Because I want to start with, like, why am I here? Right? What in the world would cause you to say, today you've got time to basically put me, like, give me 30 minutes. Like, at some point, what's going on? And it allows me to say, like, you know what? I didn't have, the hard part is people say, like, you didn't study the company. It's like, you know what? I could read the website, but the reality is, like, you're going to tell me more than the website will ever tell me. And so to me, the fact is I feel like that people overprepare, which actually makes them blind to the subtleties of what people really mean, because they assume they know what people mean. So I prefer to know nothing. Like when I have a prospect, I have a meeting right after this with a prospect, I know nothing about them. I'm like, my first question is like, how did you get to me?
Okay. Very unique perspective. It's really cool. What would you say the greatest sales lesson that you've learned over the years?
I think the greatest sales lesson I've learned is not unpacking the language of what people mean. When we say, boy, it's easy, or we say that, you know, you're going to guarantee, the reality is like, what does that really mean? And that me making assumptions most of the way through of, I understood exactly what they meant. And by the time it gets to where it's unwound, I realize I didn't have a clue what they meant by stuff. We all said the same language, but we literally were talking by each other. Mm-hmm. And so my thing is that at some point in time, it's like, how do I make sure I understand what they're saying and what they mean?
And what should all salespeople do on a daily basis to become more successful?
I think, to be honest, I think they should actually study themselves to understand what progress they're trying to make and what do they struggle with. Because the more they can be sensitive to how they struggle, they can actually then see how their prospects struggle.
And as a actionable takeaway, what should the field salespeople listening today do as a first step to getting started on demand side selling?
Yeah. What I would say is that don't settle for what I call the pablum of what people say, like, ooh, you know, this is really frustrating. It's like, how do you unpack it and ask what they mean five times? Get it down to an action of like, what does frustrating mean? Is it too much time? Is it too complicated? Is it too many steps? Is it like, what is it that makes it frustrating? And so my thing is, the number one thing is don't let people say things like easy, healthy, affordable, good value, all that. I call that the cake layer of the sale, which is all this crap that people, we all agree to this. It's like mom and apple pie. It's like, what's the meat that people are really talking about when they're talking about their problems? Unpack.
Love it. Well, I'm going to try to summarize what you've taught us today. And you know, a couple minutes here. So first of all, demand side selling is all about finding out what causes people to buy, whereas supply side selling tends to just focus on the product and its features rather than the customer. Demand side selling focuses on the language that the customer uses, and then it seeks to understand which features your product should and your pitch should focus on based on the language that the customer uses and where they are in their buy cycle.
Yeah.
You want to work to understand the context in which people buy. So salespeople should talk to people who switch products and really seek to understand what it was exactly that made them switch and what made them switch now.
Yep.
The four forces of progress that impact how people buy are, first, push, which is a struggling moment where things could be better.
Yep.
Then there's pull, the pull of the new solutions. What are the new outcomes that the customer wants?
Yep.
And push and pull both help people move forward. Then there's anxiety. Anxiety comes with that progress.
Anxiety of the new. This is where, like, you can have anxiety that's a push, but this is anxiety when you see the new thing. What are you worried about that new thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then habit. Habits need to change with progress, and anxiety and habits make it harder for progress to occur.
Yeah.
You want to find the moment that people are actually ready to buy. This is your customer's struggling moment. And finally, ask your prospects questions to understand their timeline and help them make progress.
Yep. That's it.
All right. Well, Bob, where can our listeners read more about your work? How can they reach out to you?
Yep. So they can find it. I'm on Amazon. It's basically Demand Side Sales 101. I'm working on 201 and 301, which is 201 is all about the tools and techniques for both marketing, sales, and customer success. And then 301 is about managing a demand side sales force. But right now, Amazon's the place. LinkedIn is where you can find me. I publish blog posts and things on that. I'm also on Twitter as B Mesta, M-O-E-S-T-A. And the name of the company is The Rewired Group, but we mostly there I do, I build like 22 products this year I'll launch. So mostly I'm innovating on new products. So I don't, you know, at some point I'm writing and teaching more about sales right now than I'm doing sales than I am actually consulting on sales, if you will.
Gotcha. Well, we'll put all that in the show notes. Perfect. This has been a great episode of Outside Sales Talk, and I really appreciate your time, Bob.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. If you work in field sales, you'll love Badger Maps, the number one route planner that helps you sell 20% more and drive 20% less. You can get a free trial at badgermapping.com. If anyone out there can think of other sales reps that would benefit from learning about demand side selling, like Bob's taught us here, feel free to share the love and forward this on to them. Take care until next time, everybody. This has been great.